of the least racist, least anti-Semitic president of all time. And I didn't know this. You know, I've been walking around since the 80s, really, thinking that this billionaire, supposed, alleged billionaire, because I don't know the last time that's been confirmed, was a parasitic, you know, scumbag, predatory, racist. That was my thought. But apparently, not only is he not a parasitic, scumbag, predatory racist, he's the least racist person and the least anti-Semitic. So he went to the Museum of African American History. And I have my issues with African American history. Because as Wise Intelligence said on Pure Poverty, even in school, they're telling me my history starts in slavery. You know, because so I don't think there's a such thing as African American history, because I don't really think there's a such thing as an African American. I know there's Africans in America. I know there are African people still dwelling in the United States. But I don't really think that this mythological creature called the African American, because what I understand, and if we really were going to deal with the purest definition of African American, then we would embrace and include our brothers in Nova Scotia, brothers and sisters in Nova Scotia, brothers and sisters in Canada, brothers and sisters in Mexico, Panama, you know, Central America, all of South America and the Caribbean, and even the brothers and sisters maybe in the Pacific Islands, Hawaii. Not that that's even, that's more, I don't know, maybe Asia and the West have been playing tug of war with those beleaguered colonized lands, so maybe they fall into this scope. But if we were really to be honest about African, I mean, no, I'm talking about Trump is the least racist, least anti-Semitic, not Bill Gates. Because, I mean, Bill Gates is an absolutely confirmed billionaire. But I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole. But those would be of the Americas, North and South Americas and the related territories. Those would be the true African Americans. But what we are, as Amos Wilson once said, United Statesians. So when you're dealing with strictly the United States, as African Americans, and the popular connotation means that Black people who are citizens of the United States. And citizenship entails certain privileges, certain rights, certain protections that African people have never had. We have never been fully covered or embraced by the U.S. Constitution, the agencies of the government. You know, and that's part of what we're going to talk about today when we delve into the assassination of Malcolm X and COINTELPRO. The United States has had a hostile, aggressively anti-Black stance since its inception. There's never been a time, even under the regime of Barack Hussein Obama, there's never been a time where the government has, as was so popularly stated in the civil rights era, lived up to the content of its creed. Its creed is the Constitution. And it's never, ever fully applied. So we're not fully American. And I know y'all can dig in y'all pockets and pull out your Social Security card. I know y'all can go into your grandma's shoebox under her bed or your mama's file cabinet, if she's more together, and find your birth certificate. I know that. I know on paper. I know technically we are citizens. But when you look at the history, and you look at the application, and you look at our current status, either somebody lying, somebody playing games. We were bestowed citizenship through the ratification of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment of the United States. And those were Black-specific, that was Black-specific legislation. But even the people who supposedly emancipated and freed us hated us so much they couldn't even say Black people or descendants of Africans or enslaved people. They still had to use ambiguous languages, all peoples born in land. You know, I'm not even going to rehash. I mean, there's a wonderful documentary dealing with that. They couldn't, even when they freed us, they put in a little slavery trap. They couldn't just say slavery is abolished and we're done with it. They were like, oh, slavery is abolished, except, but, dot, dot, dot. So, in reality, the African American History Museum, you're either dealing with American history, and a large segment of American history deals with the enslavement, disenfranchisement, oppression, mutilation, murder, degradation, and robbery of African people. But that's American history. It's not African American history. Because even if you want to talk about, well, we did jazz, which they stole. We created hip hop, all forms of art music, which they profit from. We did all these wonderful technological advancements. The real McCoy. Internal lubrication system for the combustion engine. The cell phone, the super soaker, all this wonderful stuff. It all falls right back into the white man gets paid off of all of that. So even if you want to highlight our accomplishments, you can't ignore who is currently profiting from our accomplishments. Who makes the most money, gets the most accolades and security? The number one export of the United States is weapons. But the number two exports of the United States are cultural products. And now, you know, we do have, I guess we got our little attempts. We got Cash Money Records coming at you in the 2000s. We got the No Limit Soldiers. We've got, you know, but when even you look at that, where black folks got their name on a building, when you look at the, like, you know, we got Jumpman Jordan. I don't know how that breaks down. Nike is Jordan. But when you look at it, you got black folks collecting checks and stamping their name on stuff. But when you look at the infrastructure, let's take Michael Jordan. The shipping, the factories, the raw materials, the chemical plants that make the synthetic materials, artificial materials, all that goes into his shoes. Does he really even know? Has he even been to an Indonesia factory? Does he have any level of ownership? The death squads, the juntas, the warlords that maintain the global system of capitalism so that they can keep foreign labor at starvation levels to prevent those, you know, citizens of foreign lands that are exploited by the capitalists. Does he have any control? Can he call up the least racist, least anti-Semitic, least the president who loves women more than any other president, Donald Trump? Can he call him up and say, deploy the Marines? Send in a special forces unit. What real power do they have? Because from my observation, the only power that these black people have is they have a greater consumption capacity. Oprah has riches, but she doesn't have the kind of power of, you know, a Rothschild, a Rockefeller, and doesn't even want it. Doesn't even want it. So I just have to ask, you know, I know Cash Money Baby and his older brother, all these rich black folks, when they're the infrastructure, the fiber optic cables that carry their degenerate anti-African death culture music into the homes and across the airways, the satellites that show the horrendous Cash Money No Limit movies, how much of that infrastructure do these rich African Americans own and control? Do they have the capacity to put up satellites, transmission towers, fiber optic cables that crisscross the oceans, the big giant freighter ships that lay those cables, the silicon, the mines, the coltan mines? So, like, yeah, I know. So what? At what point did the black elites, the African American elites, enter this economy? The fiat currency is nothing. They print fiat currency. They shred tons of cash every day and then print out brand new forms of cash. And Nixon took the United States off the gold standard. So, you know, U.S. currency is literally, and no economist would dispute this, U.S. currency is literally based on the confidence of the national and international markets. It is strictly based on the faith and good name of the United States. That's all U.S. currency, and thus for all global currency, because all currency, through threat of nuclear annihilation, through threat of toppling their government through threat of going through what Libya, Somalia, Iran, North Korea is going through. If you don't want to end up like Libya, Somalia, or North Korea, you better tie your bet. So it's based, and you know where the word, it's based on the confidence that people have in the U.S. economy, the faith and good credit and good name of the United States. Now, we already know about credit and good faith and name of the United States. If you've been within 10 feet of a history book, you know that ain't nothing to really rest on. But then where does the word con come from? A con man. It comes from the word confidence. If someone's saying strictly, trust me, you have confidence and nothing else to back it up, then you are literally being conned. So a guy by the name of B.F. Skinner figured out, you know, we can give black people. For a long time, it was thought, you know, the old pimp game. Black men think they came up with this. You got to keep a hoe broke. But it's really the Europeans came up with the pimp prostitution hoe game. They pimp whole nations. And they really thought, well, we got to keep a certain level of resources. We got to keep money out of the hands of black folks, because if black people were able to develop their own economic elite, then their elite might start acting like every other elite, having, you know, a desire for nationalism, having a desire for independent currency, having a desire for an independent military, manufacturing, infrastructure. They might start acting like everybody else acts when they get big money. They're going to want to turn big money, and since they know it's a con, they want to turn big money into real concrete resources and infrastructure and institutions. But a guy named B.F. Skinner said, listen, you can give black people money. Relax. Give them all the fiat they can eat. I mean, just stuff them till they burst at the seams with money. They won't be a threat to you. Because our indoctrination has not only been thorough over the decades, we're about to refine and intensify indoctrination. So when you would think you have a poor black whose main concern is getting things, immediate things, what can I consume today? What will I consume tomorrow? We can have blacks with billions of dollars that have that same disposition and mentality. And so you don't have black people with billions of dollars saying, why do we, you know, even an African dictator that's very comfortable saying, I'm going to buy all my weapons, all my technology from the West. I want to have a private jet. It doesn't need to be made here. You know, you have certain segments of Africa and Ethiopia and Ghana that say, hey, maybe we do need our own independent industries. And not do we not only need our own independent industries, we need the fundamental capacity to go from raw material, extract the raw material, refine, process the raw material, shape and mold that raw material into a finished good. Top, bottom. You have some places that are doing that. And we know we don't want the Japanese, we don't want the Chinese, we don't want U.S. multinational corporations to come and set that up for us. We'll do it for ourselves. You have that mentality. But it is very rare. It's very rare. So I'm saying all that to say that they decided, oh, we could have a black elite, a black bourgeoisie, a black billionaire caste. And they won't be a threat to the black, to the white elites. Because, you know, if you look at other places, you talk about gang banging. Elites bang it out. So the Chinese industrialists, the Chinese elites, the Chinese venture capitalists, they are in aggressive competition against, not with, but against the U.S., the Western capitalists. The Russian oligarchs bang on. The Chinese oligarchs, the Japanese industrialists go up against. But the U.S. industrialists, they only fight for inclusion, and they fight for expansion of their own personal consumption capacity. Consumption capacity leaves you in a state of servitude and subjugation. But then on the other side of that, you have manufacturing capacity. Let's say Jordan went into Phillip Knight's office. Well, Phillip Knight, he's the ex-CEO of Nike. And Phillip Knight said to him, you know, we want to cut you off. We're done. You know, it's been a great relationship, but I've had a change of heart. I'm a revolutionary radical. I'm going to just give away all my billions of dollars that you made for me, boy. And we're done here. Contract, rip it up, step off. Now, could Jordan say, okay, I've been cut off from Nike's infrastructure, their manufacturing, all their designs, their network, their algorithms, I'm cut off from that. But I'm still Jordan, I still got my name, I still got my legacy, and I still got billions of dollars. How long would it take him to get a new shoe out? Would he even be able to get another shoe out? Because then he would have to go to Indonesia and say, well, you know, put your slaves back to work. I'm like, says who? You know, where are your CIA contacts? Where are your FBIs? You know, where's the State Department? Who's your person at the embassy or the consulate? That's the thing. People like to think that capitalism is about hard work and sacrifice. Capitalism is nothing but parasitic socialism. Because all multinational corporations are dependent on the state. The military, intelligence agencies, diplomacies, the court systems, the patent system, the copyright, all so-called privately owned companies. Bill Gates would not be a billionaire. Bill Gates would be sniveling in a garage somewhere, picking his nose, if not for the grand apparatus of the state to enforce his patents. Because if Bill Gates had to hire goons, if Bill Gates had to truly live in an Ayn Rand libertarian situation where he wasn't able to depend on the grand apparatus of the collective input of the state, the socialist state, the collectivist state, the centralized power of the state, if he wasn't able to depend on that, then what he would have to do is go hire goons and say, oh, you know, brother Diallo Kenyatta, he's got some illegal software. Let's go knock on his door. Yeah, they might be able to get me, maybe get my neighbor. But after a while, his goons will be like, why don't we just collect for ourselves? Why are we doing this for Bill Gates? If it ain't no police, if it ain't no courts, if it ain't no jail system, which we pay for collectively. What if Bill Gates had to go in his own pocket and incarcerate and try and capture people? He's got the state to do that for him that violated his copyright. So every system, every economy in the world is socialist in operation. Capitalism is only one segment that you inject, is a virus that you insert into any economy and into any communal society, is a virus that you inject that allows a small number of people to legally extract the collective wealth and profit from the collective effort. So everything is collectivist. There's nothing individual. Bill Gates is not individual. Bill Gates is more dependent on welfare and public inputs than anybody else. Bill Gates with his mansions and his investments and his, you know, big server farms. He takes more from the infrastructure. He demands more of the infrastructure than any poor person. The most independent people in our society are the homeless people. If you really pride, I care about people being enterprising, inventive, innovative, you know, people that are willing to make sacrifices and people that can endure, people that work hard, all those qualities you only find in homeless people. I guarantee you, if you ever get an opportunity to shake Donald Trump's little bitty hands, it will be the softest things you've touched, like a little baby's butt, like a cloud of marshmallows resting in Honey Lake. I bet you that man ain't got a callus, a keloid. You know, so billionaires are not the hard workers. I know how we got here in thinking that the billionaires are hardworking. And I know I'm way off. My whole point is there's no such thing as an African American. There are African subjects of the American Empire. We are not full citizens. We have never been able to fully exercise our citizenship or fully enjoy the benefits of citizenship in America. And the United States government and all of its related branches, all of its non-governmental institutions, all of the bureaucrats within the government, including the black bureaucrats, the black soldiers, the black agents, have worked against the interest, the collective interest of black folks. And B.F. Skinner says, let's give them a stake in the system so that they will no longer have any more of these uprisings and riots and mass movements. No more of this Garvey Black Panther mess. if we take a few blacks and give them a few billion dollars and then parade them across the world stage saying, look, this nigger has money. How can you call us racist? He has no power. He controls no infrastructure. But it was announced yesterday. Jay-Z announced that he's going to start a venture capitalist firm. You know, so now we can be proud, just like when Obama was a black man ordering the drones to be dropped, the black man ordering the illegal surveillance, the black cop with his boot on your neck. Now we've got another opportunity to have a black person commit the atrocities. And do we bleed a little less when it's a black person? I'm not even going to get into that. It's just take my word for it, y'all. It shouldn't be no African-American history. It should be American history. And we should tell it, because you can't tell our African-American history without including the atrocities and crimes, past, present, and future anticipated planned crimes of white folks. You can't tell the history of African people without telling the history of, I don't know, what when the Irish migrants burnt down the black orphanage, and when the black children were crawling out, jumping out of the windows to escape the flames, they were throwing black babies back into it. Is that African history? Is that Irish history? Everybody got a hand in it. Or you want to celebrate all the wonderful inventions of African people? You got to tell the history of how they were stolen. The patents, the designs, the companies were stolen from black people. If you want to tell the great history of manager C.J. Walker, you got to tell the wonderful history of how the relentless attack on the African form motivated black folks to hate themselves so much that we were using toxic chemicals to alter our appearance, our hair texture. And any black person that could tap into that self-hatred will be the first black self-made millionaire in the country. So you can't tell nothing. You can't tell me nothing about black folks in the West without first or second or third or somewhere in there. You got to tell the history of white folks, Irish, German, Native Americans. So what is African-American history? But one segment of American history. So I think it should be the history of American. You can tell the history of lynching, but how you tell the history of lynching without including the lynchers? What the hell is African American? Now, I know what African history is, because most of our history was made. Most of our empires were built, disintegrated, and rebuilt in the rubble time and time again before, as Dr. Clark would say, before the white man ever wore a shoe, ever had a house with a window in it, ever wrote one line of poetry. So you can tell African history without having to include anybody else. But I don't know what the hell is African American history. I know what African history is. I know what U.S. history is. But even if I'm telling the history of the Black Panthers, how am I going to leave out COINTELPRO? So how you tell African American history without telling the history of whites, natives, Latinos, women, disabled, everybody? What the hell is that? Y'all tell me. Because I've taken African American history classes. And at best, it's a distortion or warping of the real history, of the entire history. But there's never been a thorough telling. But anyway, Donald Trump went to the African American History Museum, whatever the hell African American history is. I know African history. I'm willing to tell, teach, and learn as much as I can about African history. I don't know what this Yeti, this Bigfoot, this Loch Ness monster called the African American, I don't know what the hell that is. But anyway, well, why not just be African? Enough with the hyphens. You know. But anyway, Trump went there and said, he was the least racist, the least anti-Semitic, the least sexist president. So that's some good news. And then my other good news, I kind of slipped it in. Jay-Z is starting a venture capitalist firm. Step aside, Mitt Romney. All you sovereign wealth funds, step aside, all of you parasites who are choking off the Puerto Rican economy. Step aside, all you scumbags who are financing the genocide in the Congo in order to continue the blatant resource rape of that resource-rich land in the Congo. Step aside. Jay-Z is ready to apply his pimp game on a global scale. He's leveling up. Global pimping with the passport. He's big pimping all over the world, pimping entire ecosystems, pimping entire economies, pimping entire nations. No more just pimping hoes on the street corner. No more pushing drugs in Marcy. He can push toxic vaccines in Namibia. Now that's progress. Oh, doesn't it make you want to sing the Star Spangled Banner? Thank you, America. Thank you, Jay-Z, for setting that example. Obama proved that we could drone bomb as good as the white man, and now Jay-Z's going to demonstrate that we can come in after the imperialist drone bombings and buy up all the land and resources on the cheap and sell them on the global market at a profit. We can do it all. We've come a long way, baby. Anyway, that was my good news. We now have a non-racist president. I mean, we had before that, so this is really not new, because Obama didn't have the capacity to be racist. Not that he tried, he gave his, he tried his damnedest. But here's the secret. You don't have to be white to be a white supremacist. If you, and I don't like white supremacy or white supremacists, you know. But, you know, that's the, it's kind of like when people wanted us to stop saying Uncle Tom, because Uncle, they wanted to try to, what's his name? Claude Anderson wanted us to start saying, instead of calling people Uncle Tom, because Uncle Tom is actually a heroic figure. So we should stop using Uncle Tom as a disparaging phrase, that we should call people Sambos, because Sambo in the Uncle Tom's Cabin, it was all written by some uppity white woman. I don't know why she should be the standard. We should try to stick to what, but anyway. Dr. Anderson said, we really need to call Clarence Thomas and Obama's, call them Sambos, not Uncle Tom's. But I'm like, man, that ship has sailed. I don't think you're going to be able to. So, you know, certain things, even though they're not semantically, historically accurate, we all get an understanding. Well, we have. Some people say white supremacy in awe of white people, like white supremacy. Like they truly believe white is supreme. Other people say white supremacy as, you know, an unnatural, unsustainable, unjustifiable status of white people being over everybody else and that we have to fight it. That's inherent. But not all black folks that say white supremacy, they're just saying it as a stated fact, like water is wet. It is what is, and we got to figure out how we can get what we can get, you know, within their system. But anyway, we got the least white supremacy. Oh, I was saying that Obama, you don't have to be white to be a white supremacist, because white supremacy has stated ideology and it has stated practices, protocols, goals, and objectives. And if you're a black person that embraces the ideology and carry forth and enthusiastically advances the agenda of white imperialism, white domination, then you're a white supremacist, a black white supremacist. You can't be a racist. You don't have the power and authority, and they will not give you the power and authority. But you can be a white supremacist. I think we kind of confuse that. Black people can't be racist. Agreed, but a black person can receive a list of instructions that are given to him that, if carried out, will legitimize and sustain the systems and institutions of white domination and hegemony. And if they do that, then they are white supremacists. So we got a lot of black white supremacists. We even have a lot of militant nationalists, hate whitey white nationalists who are white supremacists. Because in all their hatred of white people, if you look at their fundamental way they want to structure this new black militant, black nationalist society, it's nothing but a carbon copy of white folks in terms of relationships, in terms of economy, in terms of culture and practices and you know, everything. It's just a carbon copy, literally a carbon copy from white to black. So even if you don't think white people are worthy to be in your new black world, if your black world is a carbon copy of the white system, then you obviously still think that their way is supreme. Dr. Umar, as you go establish your elite boys' school in the woods, nothing sounds gayer to me, but your anti-gay all-boys school in the woods. You know, that's what white folks do. That's not how we educated. Our education was dispersed within the community, was integrated amongst the community. You know, it was communal education, not elite set off boarding school education. That's what Europeans did. Show me an independent African boarding school that predates European boarding schools. You know, and we had apprenticeships. You know, we did have, houses, you know, where medicine and where you would be initiated into these different professions, but it wasn't like rob the children away and ferret them off in the night. That's some Greco-Roman stuff, Dr. Umar. But anyway, so we had Obama, who didn't have the capacity to be racist. So that was a plus. We had a president who didn't have the capacity to be racist, the very first one in the world. And now we have one who is the least racist in the world. Thank you, Trump, on behalf of all of us Afro-Americans, for being so not racist. And you've appointed enough people onto your cabinet and into positions of authority where you don't have to expend your energies being racist. You outsourced the hell out of that. Because you damn sure got DeVos and Bannon. You damn sure got enough races on the payroll where you ain't even got it. It's kind of like, you know, you ain't got to raise your own kids. You hire nannies. I don't have to be racist. I hire racists to racism for me. So anyway, yesterday was the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. And I want to get into that. I want to play some excerpts and do some reviews. You know, in my analysis, the two biggest triumphs of the COINTELPRO program were the assassination of Malcolm X and the assassination of Fred Hampton. Those are the two biggest achievements. Bigger than the exile of Garvey, the assassination of King, the exile of incarceration and later escape of Asada, the exile of Pete O'Neill, the false imprisonment of Geronimo Jujaga Pratt, the elevation of illegitimate black nationalist leaders, cooperators, to the helm of legitimate leadership, like Karenga or, you know, the minister. Aside from all those accomplishments, I think there are two accomplishments that, if they didn't do anything else, would have been enough to disrupt the black liberation struggle, was the assassination of Malcolm X and Fred Hampton. And I know COINTELPRO was white folks doing white things, but every single COINTELPRO mission, as I stated, as I blogged yesterday, needed and got the cooperation of black people within the struggle. But that goes to without saying. Every slave revolt, every time Europeans, white folks, had to put down a slave revolt, they had the cooperation of enough, if not most, black people, either to snitch or to take up arms to put down the rebellion. There were even instances where during, you know, the colonial era, the British Crown would go to Jamaica and raise an army of Jamaican subjects, black Jamaican subjects, and take them to Gambia to put down an uprising, or take them to Ghana. I mean, that's the history we haven't looked. I mean, Clark, before he passed, always said he was working on a book called The Role of the Bastard in History. And all these traitors and treasonous people from within our race. And with enough public relations, enough, you know, rousing speeches, a traitor can become a militant leader, you know, and we want to forget all about their treason. Just one more good, give one good speech. You do something treasonous against our people, get a good speech, get a good hashtag going, and we'll forget, you know. And then instead of people identifying your treason, they'll attack the people who want to highlight your crimes against humanity. But anyway, it is 7:38. Oh, I'm doing better with time than I thought. It's 7:38. This is AM 1680, Bro Diallo Show, Q4 Radio. Thanks for tuning in. I'm going to go to a musical break, and I want to come back, and we're going to talk about not just the assassination and what we lost and what led up to the murder, the assassination of El-Haj, Malik Shabazz, Malcolm X, and who was culpable in that murder. And one thing that's more important than anything else is, why are we so vulnerable to these types of disruptions? We don't have to be. We can truly start to enact the wisdom of Dr. Clark and bury the man and continue to plan. We don't have to lose a generation of struggle every time they clip some leader, compromise some leader, buy off, or exile or kill a leader. We can structure our movements. We can structure our education system. We can structure our communities in such a way where it will not be vulnerable. We can set things up to say if they martyr one of our leaders, it only reinforces the struggle. That's the only way to protect our brilliant leaders. But we'll talk about that. But I send this shout out and dedicate this song to COINTELPRO and all the black agents, you who are still in the halls of academia or at the helm of black organizations or not-for-profits who cooperated with COINTELPRO, who helped to bring down Assata Shakur, Black Liberation Army, who helped to bring down and dismantle the Panthers from outside and from within. You who cooperated or quote-unquote created the atmosphere that led to the death of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, the exile of Pete O'Neill, you know, the exile of Robert F. Williams. I mean, it's just too much. Too much to list. I could do 10 shows in a row just listing the warriors we've lost. And every single one of them, there was a black traitor. And we can go international with this. Nyerere, Lumumba, Biko, so Sankara. So anyway, this goes out to you, you treasonous parasites, black, white, and otherwise.
Murderer! Murderer! Sticky do da do da do da do da do da do da do da. See, tell them already, we have to tell them again. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Them a murderer. Them a murderer. See, them come in at me area, want to kill off the youth. No dress up in a jacket and them dress up in a tie. Come a court house, want to tell pale lies. Them a murderer. Aye. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Or them a clean at them cheap one, come kick out my teeth. Come in at them red one to lick off my head. Come into my lane, want to fly out my brain. Them dress up in a jacket and them dress up in a tie. Want to deprive I man from my rights. Them a murderer. Them a murderer. Aye. Watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them a come. Watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them a come. Them a vampire. Then we suck out your blood. Watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them a come. Watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them a come. Them a murderer. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Anyone we no like, we no keep them afraid. Girls we don't feel, we don't chat to them. Cause them a murderer. Them a murderer. Aye. Dress up in a jacket and them dress up in a tie. Want to deprive I man from my rights. Them muggling at them jeep walk, come kick out my teeth. Come into my lane, want to fly out my brains. Them dress up in a black, want to send a death cat. Them a murderer. Watch them, watch them, watch them a come. Watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them, watch them a come. Them a vampire. Them a vampire. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Tell them already, we have to tell them again. Anyone we no like, we no keep them afraid. Girls we no feel, we no chat to them. Cause them a murderer. Watch them, 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 watch them
They're all right? Minister Malcolm, when you broke with Elijah Muhammad back in March, you said it was because the black Muslims were too narrowly sectarian and inhibited, and because Elijah Muhammad had become blindly jealous of you and the personal following you had gathered.
Mm-hmm. I said the first part, but the last part, I didn't say that Elijah Muhammad himself had become blindly jealous. I mentioned that it was his family and the officials in Chicago. Everything that I said always was designed to protect Mr. Muhammad himself. Primarily because the image that he had created was the image that enabled his followers to remain strong in faith and things of that sort. And I didn't want to see any adverse effect or negative result develop in the faith of all of his followers. Mm-hmm. But actually, despite the fact that I tried to protect the Muslim movement, if you'll notice, they used their newspaper to slander me and to label me as a hypocrite and as a rebel, and Mr. Muhammad himself said that I defected. Well, in reality, I never even left the Muslim movement. They put me out, and they put me out because of what I knew, and what I knew was told to me by Mr. Muhammad's son, Wallace Muhammad himself. They put me out, and they put him out.
Well, now, first of all, let's find out what it is that Wallace Muhammad, Elijah Muhammad's son, told you.
Well, number one, if you notice, the stick that I always used in presenting, representing, and defending the Muslim movement was the fact that it had the ability to reform the morals of the so-called Negro community. It eliminated drug addiction, alcoholism, fornication, adultery, loose sex, sexual behavior, which meant that it eliminated bastard babies, illegitimate children. Well, as long as I knew that this was what it represented and it gave me a strong stick, I could represent it and defend it. But we had a law which was that whenever any Muslim became involved in any kind of sexual relationship with someone to whom they weren't married, that person would be brought before the Muslim community, humiliated, and then isolated for from 1 to 5 years. This was our law. Well, in 1954, a teenage sister left Detroit and became one of Mr. Muhammad's personal secretaries. And there in the Chicago office, she became pregnant after being there for a year. And she was brought before the Muslim community and humiliated and isolated. And a year later, another secretary, this time one from Lansing, Michigan, came to Chicago. She also became pregnant. She was brought before the community and humiliated and isolated. And because the other person was never brought forth during this court session, it was concluded by all of Mr. Muhammad's followers that it was a non-Muslim who was the other party. Well, we grew so rapidly that in 1957 or 58, the secretarial staff was expanded to, I think, 8 teenage sisters. In 1959, 6 of them disappeared. 2 of them reappeared in Philadelphia about 2 or 3 months later, and they were all right. The other 4 reappeared in 1960. All 4 of them had babies. All 4 of them had become involved with someone and become pregnant and had these children. So it was, from what I now know, when the 4 of them got back to Chicago and began to compare notes, they found that the same man had told all of them the same story and had made all of them pregnant, that the same man was the father of all 4 of their children and had also been the father of the children brought forth by the 2 secretaries who preceded them. Mm-hmm. So this story was kept among these sisters until 1962. 2 of them rebelled against the person who was responsible and began to tell the story all over the city of Chicago. It caused many of the Muslims in the Chicago mosque to leave and go back out in the street. They knew it, and I knew nothing about it until 1963, when Mr. Muhammad's son, who had been in prison, came out, and he had been a minister, and he was very religious and spiritual, and when he began to hear these rumors around Chicago, he went to one of the sisters, and the sister admitted to him that the rumor was true, and it was he who first told me about it, and when he told me about it, I wrote to Mr. Muhammad and told him about it, and he admitted that he had a knowledge of it, and that he'd given me a religious explanation that would fit into prophecy and all of that, so I was quiet. And it wasn't until October of 1963 that it came up again. And when it came up again, I realized that the same person who had made these other sisters pregnant was still busy doing the same thing. He hadn't stopped. Two of the sisters had two children by the same man, and one of those two sisters was pregnant still, getting ready to have a third child by the same man. So when it was known among the Chicago officials that I had a knowledge of this, they became very fearful of me. They became very antagonistic toward me, and they had to do something to diminish the authority that I had, for fear that if this became public knowledge, the followers would leave the Muslim movement and follow me. And it was at that time that they used the statement that I made against President Kennedy as a pretext to cut my authority, and some other things happened that finally produced the split, or forced the split. And when I made the split, the only reason that I didn't make this public knowledge was I knew the implications, and I felt that if the Muslims who were in the Nation of Islam knew it, that which enabled them to be so strongly religious and exercise moral discipline would be shattered, and it would cause all of them to go right back and start doing the things that they had been doing previously.
Who is the father of all of these various children whom you have enumerated?
The first one to tell me who the father was Wallace Muhammad, and he told me that the father was Elijah Muhammad himself. One of the sisters, he went to the home of one of the sisters, and when he walked in the door, she says, "I want to let you see something." And she showed him her child. She said, "Here's your brother, and your father is the father of this child." And then I questioned the sisters myself, because I was shook up. And they admitted to me that Elijah Muhammad was the father of their children. And I took it to him. And it was at that time he told me that he was Muhammad, the prophet, and that Muhammad had nine wives. He also told me that he was David. He was the modern David, and that he was the modern Solomon, and that it was meant for him to fulfill today all of the things that they did back there.
And how many of these illegitimate children did he father with the sisters?
Well, he made six sisters pregnant. They all had children. Two of those six had two children. One of those two is having a child right now. I am told that there is a seventh sister who is supposed to be in Mexico right now, and she's supposed to be having a child by him. For one thing, when you first separate from your wife, it's a physical separation, but it's not psychological. You still have feelings for her, and you protect her. But after the physical separation has taken place for a while, it becomes a psychological separation. It was the same way with me and the Muslim movement. When I first separated, it was a physical separation, but my feeling was still there. And it was only after my trip into the Muslim world and my pilgrimage to Mecca that I really was able to exercise the objective approach to it that enabled me to see that something had to be done to bring this to light. Otherwise, a whole lot of innocent people would be killed needlessly.
Well, these revelations that you are now making about Elijah Muhammad, what effect should they have on his following?
Well, I very much doubt that any of his followers who really are aware of what he has done would continue to follow him. He may try and justify it by saying that he's a Muslim, and that a Muslim has a right to these wives. If this were the case, these sisters should not have been humiliated. These sisters have been looked upon for the past 5 years, or 6 years, or 7 years as being guilty of having committed fornication. They have been debased. They have been degraded. I have heard him himself refer to them as having disgraced him. So if they were his wives, he should have given them a position of respect, so that all of his followers would respect them, and that they would have the protection of his followers today.
Well, do you feel that you then, perhaps now, should take over the leadership of the black Muslims?
No, I have no desire to take over the leadership of the black Muslims, and I have never had that desire. But I do have this desire. I have a desire to see the Afro-American in this country get the human rights that are his due. I believe that the Islam religion is the best religion for our people, because it creates unity, and it gives one dignity and racial confidence and all of these things that are necessary to make a complete human being.
Are you not perhaps afraid of what might happen to you as a result of making these revelations?
Oh, yes. I probably am a dead man already.
What do you mean?
When you understand the makeup of the Muslim movement and the psychology of the Muslim movement, as long as by having confidence in the leader of the Muslim movement, if someone came to me and I had no knowledge whatsoever of what had taken place and they told me what I'm saying, I would kill them myself. The only thing that would prevent me from killing someone who made a statement like this, they would have to be able to let me know that it's true. Now, if anyone had come to me other than Mr. Muhammad's son, I never would have believed it even enough to look into it. But I had been around him so closely, I had seen indications of the reality of it, but my religious sincerity made me block it out of my mind.
Have you received threats on your life?
Oh, yes. I first received threats on my life in December. In January, when it first became known that I had come back to New York and told the captain of the Fruit in New York, who was my right-hand man formerly, and also the secretary of the New York Mosque and the minister in Boston, when it became known that I had told them, then an effort was made to shut me up. One brother encouraged to go out to my house and shut me up. And fortunately, it was a brother who was well capable of doing so, but it was a brother who was highly intelligent. He was academically equipped to think for himself. And what he was told to do didn't add up. And fortunately, he was the one who put out a feeler to me to find out what was wrong. And I opened his eyes. And then he opened the eyes of the same crew whose job it is to do this kind of work.
You mean he was going to kill you?
Oh, yes. One of them was... An attempt was made to get one of them to wire my car with an explosive. That one is with me right now. Well, fortunately, while I was among the Muslims, I never lived beyond my means, and I have learned how to live within means. And I still have the clothes that was provided for me at that time. I'm in the house that was provided for me, although we're in a court battle. They're trying to get it back. And I have made this statement to them concerning the house that they could have it if they would take me back. That they would permit me to come before the Muslim movement, the rank and file, and explain or defend myself against all of the charges that they've made against me, they could have the house. But they are going contrary to their own laws by standing up in the mosque and indicting me, but never giving me a chance to defend myself. And they say that no one can judge me but Mr. Muhammad. In this case, Mr. Muhammad can't sit as judge because he's involved in the case.
Elijah Muhammad says of the Muslims, "We carry no arms, and we do not seek to win victory with arms. We do nothing to others that we would not have done unto us."
The two brothers were sent after me with revolvers by Joseph, the captain of the Fruit in New York. They were armed. When a Muslim is attacked, and you find this to be the pattern, when the Muslims were attacked in Monroe, Louisiana, Elijah Muhammad gave no signal to anybody across the nation to come to the defense of their brothers. When our brothers were attacked in Los Angeles, again, Elijah Muhammad gave no signal to anybody to come to the defense of those brothers. Never have the Muslims anywhere in the country gotten any kind of instruction from the national office or headquarters on how to defend themselves when they are attacked by outsiders. The only times the Muslims have ever been given any instructions to commit violence is when that violence is directed against a fellow Muslim. His followers are violent against Negroes.
Against Negroes?
Yes. His followers will go out and attack another Negro, like they will attack me, or they will brutalize a fellow Muslim who breaks the law. But you don't find those same followers going out and becoming involved in the Negro struggle in any way whatsoever. Now, the violence that he accuses me of is my tendency to want to participate in the struggle of the Negro at all levels. This is what he calls violence.
One question before we go further with that. Has Wallace Muhammad left the black Muslims?
Wallace Muhammad was put out of the Muslim movement right along with me.
As far as you are concerned, you will accept the fealty, if you will, of any Negro, anywhere, under any conditions.
You have to define fealty.
Well, you won't want them to give you their loyalty.
Not me, their loyalty. I'm not seeking for the loyalty of any Negro. But I am seeking for Negroes to learn how to be loyal to themselves. And when the Negro learns how to be loyal to himself, our problem is pretty well solved.
Do you feel that your message, apparent message of love that you brought back from Islam is the real reason they're after you? Because you're not hating as hard as they want you to.
Well, I never did hate anybody hard, but I do know that when I wrote that letter saying that there were white people in Mecca, it shook up a lot of Muslims, because most of the Muslims who follow Mr. Muhammad absolutely believed that it was impossible, physically impossible, I should say divinely impossible, for a white person to go to Mecca. And my trip there shattered that image or that misconcept.
Anyone call you directly, Malcolm?
Oh, I've been receiving calls ever since I left Black Muslim Movement.
And what sort of calls, Malcolm?
Isn't it disenchanted in view of the fact that these men who are your brothers are making threats against your life?
No, because actually it's not their fault. Most of them, now Joseph and the officials, they have a knowledge of what it's all about. But the rank-and-file Muslim brother does not know what it's all about. They are out of religious sincerity. They think that they are doing the will of Allah by protecting a man who I myself taught them was divine. So I don't in any way fault them. But those who are over them and give the orders, and actually the ultimate order comes from Elijah Muhammad himself. As long as I represented the Black Muslim movement as an example of morality, unity, and militancy, as long as I could do that, I represented it. It was when I realized that it could not be represented as that, that I came on and started working among the non-Muslim Negroes, as I announced in January, and I had no intention, or rather March, and I had no intention of ever even speaking on this. Had they left me alone, you still wouldn't know what really took place.
Why are they threatening your life?
Well, primarily because they're afraid that I will tell the real reason that they've been, that I'm out of the Black Muslim movement, which I never told. I kept to myself. But the real reason is that Elijah Muhammad, the head of the movement, is the father of 8 children by 6 different teenage girls, 6 different teenage girls who were his private personal secretary. The one who first made me aware of this was Wallace Muhammad, Mr. Muhammad's son. And I had stated in a newspaper.
All right, that was, I wanted to share that in almost its entirety because, you know, that was the part where Malcolm X said himself that he was a dead man, that there had been several attempts on his life, and he pegged people that he personally knew, that he trained and educated and mentored, were part of the perpetrators. Now, we all know COINTELPRO, but one thing we have almost no control over is what our enemies are going to do. But we should, at the very least, exercise some internal control and accountability. At least tell the truth where the truth is known.
Tonight, a new documentary is raising questions about the assassination of Malcolm X.
The new documentary is called Brother Minister, the assassination of El-Hajj Malik Shabazz Malcolm X. And in it is contained passages from a speech by Louis Farrakhan. And here is one excerpt.
What did you got to say about it? Did you teach Malcolm? Did you make Malcolm? Did you clean up Malcolm? Did you put Malcolm out before the world? Was Malcolm your traitor or was he ours? And if we dealt with him like a nation deals with a traitor, what the hell business is it of yours?
That was in 1993.
Really? A few months ago.
Yeah.
Mm.
On Savior's Day, I believe.
I see.
Tonight, the Nation of Islam is reacting with anger to allegations that have put its leader under fire. Those sensational charges are in a story we told you about exclusively on News 4 New York last night. The widow of Malcolm X is accusing Louis Farrakhan of involvement in Malcolm's assassination.
I'm Kurt Loder with MTV News. The controversy surrounding Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan grew even more heated this weekend when Betty Shabazz, the widow of the slain Nation of Islam defector Malcolm X, implicated Farrakhan in her husband's assassination. It happened on an NBC Sunday morning show called News Forum when reporter Gabe Pressman showed Shabazz this video clip from an as-yet-unreleased documentary of Farrakhan addressing a closed-door meeting of his followers in 1993.
Was Malcolm your traitor or was he out?
Do I think that Louis Farrakhan had... Of course, yes. I mean, it was a matter of, it was a badge of honor. I mean, nobody kept it a secret. It was a badge of honor. Everybody talked about it.
There was no love lost between Malcolm X and Louis Farrakhan, the current leader of the Nation of Islam, but now the widow of Malcolm X has made a stunning allegation that Farrakhan was involved in some way in her husband's assassination.
I would like to know, in that film strip that I just saw, I didn't see the documentary. But I'd like to know, what is it that they claim Malcolm did?
Members of the Nation of Islam were convicted. But the current leader of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, now acknowledges that words he spoke may have triggered the assassination.
As I may have been complicit in words that I spoke, I acknowledge that and regret that any word that I have said caused the loss of life of a human being.
Malcolm X was murdered 35 years ago in 1965. Today, the black revolutionary, once feared and misunderstood, enjoys the popularity and respect reserved for leaders like Martin Luther King Jr. The autobiography of Malcolm X was named by Time magazine as one of the 10 most important nonfiction books of the last century. And Denzel Washington was nominated for an Academy Award for his portrayal of Malcolm in Spike Lee's film. Who killed Malcolm X? Three black Muslims, members of the Nation of Islam, were convicted. Two of them served 20 years. The third is still not free. But the current leader of the Nation of Islam, Louis Farrakhan, has long been suspected as the instigator, the behind-the-scenes force who triggered the killing. Malcolm's late widow believed that, as do his children to this day. But now, finally, Atala Shabazz, the eldest daughter of Malcolm X, and Louis Farrakhan agreed to talk about the assassination for the first time in front of a reporter. For Shabazz, not without some misgivings.
I did not know if I wanted to sit across from him. I didn't know if my heart could handle it.
Didn't know if she could sit with a man she still holds responsible for her father's death. Confronting Minister Farrakhan would not be easy. And for strength, she told us, she summoned the memory of her parents.
Before I came here, I prayed and included my parents. They had to walk with me to the airport. They had to get me out of that hotel and into the property here.
You see, Atala Shabazz was there in the Audubon Ballroom in 1965 in New York to watch her father make a speech. She was there with her two younger sisters and her pregnant mother. And Atala, only 6 years old, watched as gunmen killed her father. Here's how her late mother, Betty Shabazz, described the murder.
I heard shots, and I saw people crawling on the floor. And so I got down too. Then when I was looking out, and I saw someone look in amazement to the front. I knew they had shot my husband. And my children were crying, you know, what's going on? What's going on? Are they going to shoot us?
I'm a child with a forever memory of the most significant man in my life standing at a podium and falling backwards. That's forever.
Ms. Shabazz, for several months, I carried the picture of your father with all of these bullet holes in his chest. And I looked at the man that taught me, the man that nurtured me, the man that was the example of a man to me. And I wept.
His pain came from their shared history. As is well known, Malcolm was a dope peddler and street hustler. But during his 7 years in prison, he was introduced to the teachings of Elijah Muhammad, considered a holy man by his followers in the Nation of Islam. And eventually, Malcolm became the spokesman for the nation, at the time preaching that the white man was evil and calling for the separation of the races. And along the way, Louis Farrakhan, a former nightclub singer, became Malcolm's student, his acolyte. And Malcolm taught Farrakhan how to live as a black Muslim. Example,
Nation of Islam members don't eat pork, don't smoke, don't drink alcohol, and do not have sex outside marriage.
It is worthy, if you will, of expulsion.
That is correct.
Adultery.
That is correct. Fornication was worthy of expulsion.
But in 1963, Malcolm X learned that Elijah Muhammad himself had repeatedly committed adultery with some of his teenage secretaries and had children with them. Malcolm agonized over his discovery, and in June of 1964, he told me about it.
And he called some of these women who were living in Los Angeles at the time.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Oh, have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop at the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Yes, some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs. All I ever have, redemption songs. These songs of freedom, songs of freedom.
All right, I'm back. Bro Diallo Show, AM 1680, Q4 Radio. One second. Hello? Yeah. Okay, hold on. Sorry about that. And I'm truly back again. Now, we all know and we all well understand that COINTELPRO is ultimately responsible. When Malcolm X was doing his pilgrimage, his Hajj to Mecca, when he was meeting with various anti-colonial forces in Indonesia, throughout West Africa, he was being followed and surveyed. The nation did not have the resource or the skill to do that. Malcolm X's phone was tapped. His hotel rooms were tapped. He was under constant surveillance. The Nation of Islam did not have the resources or the authority to carry out such surveillance. We know that Malcolm X had been a target of the COINTELPRO since the inception, or the because the first COINTELPRO was carried out against white anarchists and socialists and communists before the First World War, actually. But as I stated, in all of their efforts to disrupt our movements of freedoms, to delegitimize or neutralize our leaders, every single time, our oppressors have had black allies. In fact, in their overall struggle to dominate, oppress, and eventually exterminate us, our oppressors have more black allies than they have black enemies. There are more black people on the face of the earth that cooperate with our enemies against the interests of our people than those that fight against them. Because I account those black people who are neutral in the struggle between a decolonized, liberated, and autonomous Africa, a free and united and empowered African diaspora, the people who say, who take no position in that effort, then they are also allies of the oppressors. Because this is a struggle which you either have to actively engage or you're against your people. Now, we all have known this story. Many people from the cultural community, we all know this, the accusations that whirl around and the admissions of the minister and the Nation of Islam. We all knew Sister Betty Shabazz, Dr. Betty Shabazz, her positions and what she articulated. You know, we're familiar with that story, but it's not something we should allow to be background noise. This should be at the forefront of our understanding, especially when the minister still holds the level of influence and power, when he's able to rally millions of us to D.C. on a whim. So this story is not ancient history. This is contemporary history that we are still living with. The impacts and repercussions of the murder of Malcolm X still plague our community, still plague our efforts today. Like I said, if you were to ask me the two biggest triumphs of our enemies with the COINTELPRO program was the assassination of Fred Hampton and the assassination of Malcolm X. And the assassination of Dr. King would not have happened without first assassination of Malcolm X. So even if you tend to want to roll with Dr. King and be integrationist and take spits in your face and blows to your head in order to walk hand in hand with your oppressor, even if that's your disposition, if you're still that menticidal, Malcolm X made the statement that if they don't put their hands on Dr. King, Malcolm X laid down the gauntlet and said, King is under my protection. So they understood. Before they could even move on King, they had to move on Malcolm X. So Malcolm X, Dr. King's life was tied to Malcolm X's. And that's why, just a couple of years after they killed Malcolm X, they had already had in motion the plot to murder Dr. King. But they knew they had to remove Malcolm X first, because they knew that vacuum of influence and power that Dr. King would inhabit would have been filled by Malcolm. And Malcolm would have taken off the gloves. Malcolm would have taken off the tie, and he would have ended the pragmatic struggle. And who knows what would have happened. Instead of a reactionary uprising and riots all over the country, we could have had trained, militarized units. And he already had connections from Congo, Ghana, Indonesia, Cuba, to send reinforcements and supports. Who knows what would have happened? The government knows the great potential threat that that was. And they also knew killing Malcolm X drove Dr. King further to look at Dr. King prior to 1965, his methods, his words, his speeches, and look at Dr. King after 1965. Dr. King filled the vacuum and the void left by Malcolm X. So they both have to go, which I understand. When you engage in a conflict, as George Jackson said, if you wage war against this system and don't expect them to, you either, and don't expect them to retaliate, you either have a death wish or you're stupid. So my issue is not that the system retaliated. My issue is not that the system even assassinated our leaders. All's fair in love and war, as they say. My issue is that the cooperation that they get from people within our community, and not even cooperation, assistance, validation that our enemies get from the people within our community, the people who are supposed to be within the movements of revolution, the militant people who tell us that the white man is the devil, who tell us that the system is against us, who tell us that we need our own nation. Those people are cooperating with our enemy, on the payroll of the enemy. That's the problem. Because how the hell are we going to have external and hold those who attack us from the outside accountable if we don't hold ourselves accountable from within? And I'm not even mad at those individuals, but the masses of us who still give them a platform, who still show up to their lectures, who buy their books, who donate to their causes. And not even the blameless masses, but the people who have this intimate knowledge will still break bread with these individuals, who still sit on a platform, on a panel discussion, sit across from these individuals so that they too can get the spotlight. There's a lot of shame to go around, a lot of blame to go around. And at the very least, we can't just drive such individuals into obscurity. But here's another thing that I think is even more important than figuring out. I ain't got enough fingers to point. Fingers, toes, and hair follicles. If I use all those to point, it ain't enough to go around. We need to construct our movements and our organizations to be resilient, to anticipate the enemy's actions, to anticipate the treason, the lack of discipline, the lack of commitment, and already have a structure to withstand that. When they built skyscrapers in Japan, they built them with the full knowing that there will be earthquakes and tsunamis. So you don't build this grand structure and say, oh, look at this wonderful thing we did. And when the earthquake comes, when the tsunami comes, oh no, woe is we. What can we do? They build their skyscrapers in Japan to withstand earthquakes and tsunamis because they said, what is the environment? What is the climate in which we're working in? We are on a rock in the middle of the ocean that is on a fault line. So if you're on a relatively small island in the middle of the ocean, the ocean's going to, at time, try to retake the land. And if you're on a fault line, things are going to shake, rattle, and roll. So we build our structures with the anticipation, with an awareness of the climate that we're in, and with the intent to endure. And it's not just that. Even here in the United States, when you construct something, they anticipate fire, termites, erosion, rats, neglect. You have to build with the anticipation of what are the risks in the environment that you're building in. If you're building in an area that's prone to fires, then you have to have not just flame retardants and water sprinklers. You also have to say, how do we reduce the risk of fire? You know, do we cut the trees and the brush around, have a certain perimeter? There's things you can do. So no matter what you build, whether it's a building structure or an organization, you got to anticipate the risk. And then you compensate for the risk, and then you go above and beyond that compensation. You have what they call redundancies. You don't calculate just how much money, how much water does it take to put out a fire. You say, we're going to drench and saturate everything. The sprinklers are going to dump tons of water on this. And then on top of that, we're going to have a fireman. So while the sprinklers are going on inside, we're going to have the firemen come from the outside and spray them from the outside. That's redundancy. So what am I saying? How does that relate to organizing? When you have a prominent individual in an organization, when you have a charismatic individual, every person within any organization, whether it's a guerrilla, armed guerrilla movement in the bush, or some political policy organization in the middle of the civilized world, quote unquote, you have redundancy. Every single member of the organization should be trained for three positions above and three positions below, and not just move above or below, but laterally. The leader should be willing to mop and strip floors, and the people mopping the floors in the meeting hall should be prepared to take a leadership position if called upon. There should be ongoing training, ongoing academic engagement, ongoing internal critique and discussion. So there is no head to decapitate. We need to stop with the leader for life, and we need to stop with the charismatic leader. If there's an organization, every time they do a press conference, every time the media or the public's engaged, it's the same damn person up there talking. They only got one talker in the whole damn organization. Only one person that can get the people riled up. If you got to bring in speech coaches, if you got to go out and buy Dale Carnegie's book, How to Win Friends and Influence People, and assign everybody to read that damn book, whatever you got to do, you need more than just one charismatic person. Only one person you named you got to put up to get people out. Every single black prominent leader should have at least a dozen young people who are at least a decade younger than them that they're grooming to take their position. But we got our black leaders do everything in their power to prevent anybody from even getting close to their spot. And they could be 80, 85, 90 years old and still thinking, planning what they're going to do in the next 10 years. They're not about liberation. They're about their own ego. They're about their own fiefdom. Tell them the system of monarchy is dead. It is dead. It's time for us to bring out the political guillotines and decapitate these monarchs. And then you're passing, instead of the lineage going on to the most competent person, it goes on to the relative or the biggest sycophant, the yes man. So whenever you have an organization and you're engaging the public, there should be dozens of people say, hey, anybody. Pick anybody. Pick this young sister. Pick this older brother. Pick this elder. They can speak on the subject. Our people are all educated. So you take me out, it's going to be 10 more people that can step up. The line of succession is already there. So all you're doing for our organization, you're not disrupting our organization. You're creating martyrs. You're giving us more rally points. You're reinforcing my statements. When I say the system is violent, it's corrupt, and you take me out, you're proving my point. We got to stop having these tragic figures. It's no more tragedy. You bury the man, continue the plan. If somebody's taking a stance and they get taken out, incarcerated, exiled, then they're like, oh, this person was identified a threat. We need to push harder in the direction they were going. We don't retreat. Because if by the time the system's moving against you, then you know that's the way to go. So let them know, man, if we take this guy out, if we take this sister out, if we exile this person, if we set them up on trumped up charges, then we saw what happened the last 2, 3, 4 times we did this. That's just going to make more people join the cause. And the only way to do this, the first thing you have to do is you have to make the mission superior to any individual. The mission, the trajectory, the methods, the protocol, the vision, that is the leader. What are we here to do? Empowerment. Whatever your mission is, whatever your mission is, that is your leader. And everybody in the organization, from the highest member to the lowest member, needs to be subordinate to that mission. And there needs, if there's any addendums, any change, there needs to be a structured, democratic way to say, hey, if we're going to change or adjust or depart. Now, you can change methods every day. for your methodology, you can change that every day. Okay, we're going to take up arms. Arms ain't working. We're going to lobby Congress. Okay, now we're going to try to amass, you know, fiat currency and then put some fiat currency into various business. We're going to focus heavy on education. We're going to take money from education and put it into propaganda. You can change your methods. But the mission. Now, that should not be something that you can change at a whim. You know, that's not something. The fundamental principles. Those need to be near impossible to change. You know, you will have to have an organizational convention where all the members, rank and file, everybody needs to come down. You got to plead your case, and you need an 85% majority to say, oh, we need a new mission. We wanted Pan-African. We wanted repatriation back to the continent of Africa. But now we're going to try to set up some territory here. That's a fundamental change in a mission. And we need an 85% majority. You know, and whoever proposes this change and say, hey, if the change don't come, then I'm going to step down from any position of authority. So you risk your standing in the group, because by the time you're calling for a fundamental change in the mission, you should be able to put your name, your reputation, and your status on the line so that people don't just come up, huh, I see a better way to get paid. I see a way to make a move. We need to get serious about our revolution. We got people that go to work every day for multinational corporations, go to work at their government jobs, and they follow the rules. And it don't matter if they like their coworker or not. For some of these jobs, they ain't even uptight on the payroll. Every time they turn around, they got to go down to human resources, which is an insult in itself, calling you a resource. But anyway, you got to go to human resources to haggle over your check. But you're going to be there tomorrow and the next day and the next day. You show up at a black meeting. You show up to do the work of your people in your community. If they got the kind of cheese dip you don't like, you ready to flip the whole table over and end the whole movement. You'll put up with insults and discomforts and hardships with it for your damn job. But the stuff you say that's for your mission, that's supposed to be here long after you're gone. The work you're supposedly doing for your descendants. The work you're doing on behalf of your ancestors. That's something you can flip on, jumping from organization to organization, group to group. Ideology to ideology. We don't take that serious. And I'm saying don't mess with people that ain't serious. There's enough. The people who aren't serious, they got a lot of company. They'll never be lonely. It's get with people who are serious. So, as we get back to the core point, make the ideology, make the mission the leader. Nobody is superior to that. Nobody can change that. Nobody can say, okay, today we're space cowboys and tomorrow we're Egyptians. Today we're building temples in New York City. Tomorrow we're building pyramids in Atlanta. Let's just flip. Well, grand leader says so. And you look. These are not organizations. These are cults of personality. Nobody else has any say. The leader handpicks people. The leader is able to handpick and put people in positions and take people out. That's an oligarchy. That's a dictatorship. And how you going to try to get free from oppression when the structure of the organization that's supposed to help you get free from oppression is oppressive? How you going to question your oppressor when you can't question the local leader of your organization? How you going to hold the system to account when you can't even hold the mission or the people within your own organization to account? And don't let them run that unity hustle on you. Any unity that can't withstand critical assessment, any unity that can't stand up to serious questioning and review, it's not unity you want to keep. It's rotten. It's spoiled. It's beyond its expiration date. Throw it away. Instead of bringing us together, pooling our resources, and making us a stronger unit, unity is now used to quell dissent within organizations. And then people say, we need unity. We got unity. People want to deny unity, so they have you. If somebody got you looking for something you already got, they running game on you. They running game on you. It's like somebody looking for their glasses that are on top of their head. If they're looking all around, they'll never find those glasses. So the people, just watch those people that say, that always bringing up unity. How do I know we got unity? Look at our economic status. Look at our social economic standing. Look at mass incarceration. We all going through the same stuff. And if you line a million black folks up in this country and ask them certain fundamental questions, do you think black people should be free? Yes. Are you against police brutality? Yes. We are unified on all the big issues. There might be some stuff, okay, I pray to this fictional God, I pray to that fictional God, I don't believe in God. You have some divergence, but on the fundamental things about, do you want jobs? Do you want your children to have a good education? Yes. Do you want your children to have nutritious food? Yes. Do you want adequate housing, clothing, and shelter? Yes. Unity! So on all the stuff that matters, we're unified on. So we need to stop complaining about the lack of unity. We just misuse our unity. We squander our unity. There's people that make six figures a year and always broke saying they need more money. No, you don't need more money. You just need proper management of what you got. It's the same thing with black unity. And I know I'm short on time, but these are things that are very important. That when you join an organization, if you're a long-term member of an organization, or as you, like I'm doing, building an organization from the ground up, these are some fundamental things that we need to understand. I'm already, before my organization has even launched, I'm already cultivating people to come up and replace me. And the leader is the greatest servant. The leader should be the most accountable, not the person that people question the least. The leader is a title. Who is the leader of America? And if you say Trump, I'm going to smack your face. Trump ain't the leader of America. Who's the leader of capitalism? Who's the leader of Zionism? Who's the leader of Christianity? Again, if you say the Pope, I'm going to smack your face. These are things that exist no matter who. You can put Trump in. People, you know, how can you get two people more different than Trump or Obama? How can you get two individuals more that look different, have a different style, but they better get with that fundamental program? Even Trump, you see, with all his superficial, oh, I'm going to kick out all the immigrants, with all that tough talk, you see, the fundamental status quo has not been touched. He can say the media this, the media that, but you notice he'll never talk about the consolidation and ownership of the media. He keeps Rupert Murdoch and General Electric. He keeps certain names, the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. He talk about draining the swamp. There's certain names, certain institutions he keeps out of his orange mouth. He don't go there. He won't take his pussy grabbing hands and touch none of that. There's a third rail of politics that you don't touch. And everybody's just now, they talking about, Trump is anti-Semitic. I ain't heard him say nothing about cutting the Israel weapons, cutting money that the government gives to Israel. You know, he might be anti-Semitic, but he damn sure ain't anti-Zionist. So even when you get a leader, the fundamental infrastructure, the fundamental status quo does not change. But we black organizations, you get a new leader, the whole fundamental character of the organizations change. The whole fundamental character, because we have cults of personality. Leaders need to be interchangeable. The leader say, hey, when the leader steps into his position, like, here are your duties, here are your responsibilities, and here's the intervals from which you will have to come before a council, come before the organization, come before the people, and hold to account to show that you are worthy of this position. And it could be a yearly review, a two, or hey, we can imitate the oppressor every 4 years, every 5 years. We've got people in position for 30 years of our organization that has a stated mission. The organization has not only not progressed on that mission, but has lost ground. And that leader is more popular and more dug in than ever. Y'all not serious. People playing games out here, y'all. People playing games out here. If you don't like our leaders being assassinated, then build that redundancy and resilience in our organizations, and our leaders will not be assassinated. It's too risky. Why do you think they killed Gaddafi, but the Kim Jong-un and Kim Jong-il and his father were never touched? As evil as our oppressors are, they're also very calculating. They think, well, we talk, we all about action. We don't want to talk. These people have boardrooms on boardrooms. They have academic centers. They have think tanks, and they review every option. What if we kill them? What if we bomb them? What if we poison them? What if we ignore them? Can we buy them off? Can we intimidate them? They go over every option. And I guarantee you, not one of those people in the elite stood up and said, why are we doing all this talking? Let's take action. They take him out back and shoot him. I was just at a meeting to deal with violence, saving our black boys. I was just at a meeting. Hundreds of people, PhDs and ministers, all these affluent, successful, intelligent black folks. And on the flyer, it said, this is a meeting. And then it says, here's the agenda of the meeting. Here are the specific issues that we're going to be discussing. Here are the statistics related to the issues that we will be discussing in this meeting. And lo and behold, some dude, some old mouth breather stands up like, we need to take action to go out on the street because I ain't with this meeting. And I'm like, did the flyer that you got say this is action? We're meeting to take action, action, action. Come do it, join in the actions. And then when you got there, ha ha, we're going to be meeting and talking. Tricked you. Like, what are you doing? Why do people who ain't with all that talking show up places where we doing all that talking? I've never understood that. I've never understood that. And being someone who does also take action. I know when King Dita and I are out there in 90 degree weather tending to some vegetables and trying to capture baby rabbits and relocate them so, you know, it's a no-kill garden. I sure don't see all those action, those anti-talkers. I don't see y'all. When we're doing our Chelsea communal fitness, trying to bring fitness and camaraderie and cooperation, when we out in the sun doing our communal Chelsea fitness, I don't see the Action Jacksons out there either. I see y'all at the meeting denouncing, talking, denouncing, and discouraging the intellectual work. But I mean, maybe y'all somewhere else taking y'all actions. I don't know. Maybe y'all don't want it with the stuff I could. The actions I come up with, y'all don't like. It ain't, you know, fruitful. So invite me to your actions and I'll come on the air and apologize. Say, hey, I went to Action Jackson's action meeting for activity and it was very active. Nobody said a word. There was no planning. There was no premeditation. There was no structure because that will require talking. There was no communication. We just all came and started flailing our arms and running in circles but we were busy. Very, 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 very busy. And nobody was doing all that talking. There was some screaming, but no talking. I don't know what these cats are thinking. But the bottom line is, we don't have to reinvent the wheel. Everybody from the Viet Cong to Theodore Herzl and his Zionist movement to Ho Chi Minh, Mao Zedong, Patrice Lumumba, Kwame Ture, all African People's Revolutionary Party. We have people that have demonstrated us. This is how you build a resilient, multi-generational revolutionary body. And when I say revolution, it ain't always progressive revolution. Sometimes it's repressive revolution. Things fall to the right or things can fall to the left. You have right-wing revolutionaries like you have left-wing revolutionary. You have white Eurocentric Republican revolutions. You know, you have fascist revolutions. But there are certain fundamental baseline characteristics. Like fundamental elements, like carbon of organization. Like everything has carbon. It's carbon-based life forms, carbon-based energy. You know, the carbon, there's certain fundamental elements, molecules, atoms, that are universal to all organizations, whether you're reviewing the Nazi Party or the Mau Mau Uprising. That if you want your organization, you want your movement, your structure to be successful, there's certain fundamental things you have to do. And one thing you really have to... Now, it's okay to have historical figures. You know, it's okay to have, you know, mascots or whatever. People to rally around. But let me tell you, the mascot ain't the general manager of the team. So if you got an organization and there's somebody that can attract a lot of people, and I'm going to say it, you know, like Ghazi in the Uhuru movement. If you got somebody that's animated, that attracts a lot of attention, brings resources, and they can get out there. Yeah, and then by all means, unleash them. But I'll tell you this, it's not wise to put real power in the hands of the mascot. If you go to a basketball game or a football game, and I wish I could name some mascots. I don't know the name, but you know, the people wearing it, everybody cheers. Oh, everybody recognizes. Little kids want to take picture with it. You know, that's almost as popular as the players. But I tell you what, the mascot does not go up in the office and go over the draft picks. Nobody's showing the budget to the mascot. You know, you need real bureaucrats. And I know bureaucracy, planning, all that Poindexter stuff, these Action Jackson men of action don't like that, but that is necessary. You need bureaucrats. You need policy professionals. You need researchers in your organization. You need ongoing discussion. You need to struggle with ideas and concepts as much as you need to struggle against police brutality. You have to review methods. Every revolution is an academic pursuit. Anyway, I gotta, you know, my time is up. We're gonna definitely get into this more. You know, but this is how it should be done. Rest in peace to Malcolm X. But we really time to honor Malcolm X, learn from Malcolm X, but we ultimately have to bury the man and continue the plan. Malcolm X's mission with the Organization of African Unity was pan-African resistance to oppression, decolonization of Africa, and empowerment of Africans of the diaspora. Simple mission, and it's not even impossible. You know, knowing what to do is relatively easy. Executing it when you have a people who are traumatized and under constant bombardment. But we have to get mature and serious about our mission. This is Bro Diallo Show. DialloKenyatta.com, AfricanWorldOrder.com, Q4.org. Please support. Please engage. Peace.